We are talking today with Robert Jensen. He is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas in Austin and also author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Robert, thanks for coming in today.
Great to be with you, Mike.
Let me begin by asking you what the motivation is in writing this new book.
Well, after September 11, 2001, I did a lot of writing, a lot of speaking, and continued to do a lot of political organizing in Austin and nationally. And it was a time in which there was a lot of despair, a lot of people very afraid. A lot of people saw the country heading in a direction that was very frightening, and not everyone felt like there was much they could do about it. So a lot of my work has been to try and make sense of complex issues, but also do that and convey all of that with a sense of hope and a sense of purpose. Sometimes when you look at how bad the world is, you look at the statistics around economic inequality and war, poverty, all of that, it can be very overwhelming. And it leads some people, I think, to feel paralyzed, like there's nothing that can be done. And so this book is, I think, in a sense, tries to help people think through the nature of the problems, how to counter them, how to talk in a way that doesn't sort of give in to the way these issues are framed by the people in power, how to explain why politically progressives are sort of in the hole. Why is it that we live in a culture that's so radically skewed to the right and also so depoliticized? And then finishes by talking a bit about what I think we need to think about for the future, both in terms of our own commitment and also this, again, to come back to this theme of hope, why we should have hope, why we shouldn't simply give up and say, well, the forces of sort of reaction are so strong that there's nothing that can be done, because, of course, there are things that can be done.
Do you see the book as primarily aimed at, quote-unquote, progressives, or is it aimed at a wider audience?
Well, I wrote it in a sense with people who were already politicized in some generally left direction, especially folks with anti-war politics. But at the same time, I tried to write in a way that would be accessible to anyone and would be logical and clear in a way that even people who aren't part of those movements could engage with it. That's always been very important to me. I teach in a university, and I've done scholarly writing, which always seems designed to confuse more than it does to clarify. But I also was a journalist for much of my career and tried to develop the capacity to write clearly, concisely for ordinary people as well. And that's always been the way I've approached writing. The goal is to connect with people in a way that can bring new information, but also will resonate with people almost at an emotional level. Will speak to people in some language that they're familiar with. Probably the best endorsement I got for the book was when my father, who's a classic small-town Republican conservative businessman, read it and said, well, I don't agree with everything, but I understood it. In other words, that told me I had written in a way that even someone with quite radically different politics than my own could make sense of it.
The second half of the book, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, is loss of humanity something that is automatic from an empire, or is that something that's unique to this current empire?
Well, I think that subtitle does speak to the way in which if you live in some sort of oppressive system from which you benefit, that is, you can make this argument, I think, in a lot of ways. If you're a white person living in a white supremacist society, if you're a man living in male-dominant society, or if you're an American living in a world that is dominated by the U.S. empire, there's always a struggle to really claim one's own humanity because the system of power that gives you those privileges and those material comforts, in a sense, requires that you remain silent. And I think when we are silent in the face of serious injustice, we cannot really claim to be fully human. That is, this is, an argument. It's my own philosophy. It's certainly not some empirical fact I'm trying to argue. But I think that's what I take it to mean to be fully human, to not simply look away. And people acknowledge this all the time, especially after World War II and the experience of Germany. it was understood that it wasn't enough to say, well, I didn't participate in the atrocities. I wasn't a Nazi. I didn't, you know, engage actively supporting them. But, of course, the world looked and said, yes, but you did nothing to stop them as well, the good German syndrome. So I think we all recognize at some level that if one lives in such a system, one has a moral obligation to resist it. And I think it's that resistance to oppression, to hierarchy, to authority, that really makes us fully human. And I would say it's for, you know, for people living here, it's a constant struggle. It's not a state of being you achieve. It's that notion that you will always struggle against those unjust impositions of power that I think makes us, you know, gives our lives meaning and makes us fully human.
For your average person, I think a lot of the first hurdle would be just recognizing mm-hmm. that they are in an empire.
Right. Yeah, that's an important place to start. And if we were having this conversation 3 or 4 years ago, to even talk of the U.S. as an empire would have immediately branded us as the loony left. But we can dispatch with that now because this, after 9/11, even conservative thinkers routinely will talk of the United States as an empire. There was our lead article in the Atlantic Monthly, you know, serious establishment journal, about a year ago by Robert Kaplan, big conservative thinker, who said, let's stop fussing about whether or not we're an empire. We are. Let's go about the business of figuring out how to run the world better. So when people on the right are calling the U.S. an empire, I think we can start using the term without lots of concern. What does it mean to claim the U.S. as an empire, though? Well, here I think it's pretty clear. It's not only is the U.S. an empire, but it's the most dominant empire the world has ever seen. A lot of people will say, but wait, aren't empires about, you know, having colonies and sort of claiming territory, which the United States clearly doesn't do around the world? And in the post-World War II era, no one really claims territory. But that doesn't mean the United States isn't trying to dominate the world in certain ways. It's true we don't run the world like the British ran the Raj in India, for instance. But rather than directly acquiring territory, the United States has a history of manipulating, either through economic pressure or military intervention or proxy wars, manipulating the politics of other countries to install in positions of power compliant governments, essentially often just puppet governments that, if not taking orders directly from Washington, are certainly aware that they owe their existence and continued survival to Washington. Well, that's to a large degree the story of U.S. relations in Latin America for decades. It's a story of U.S. attempts to impose such governments in Southeast Asia, in Southern Africa, and of course, crucially, given the energy resources of the Middle East. Well, that's an empire. At any given moment, the United States today has something like a military presence in something like 140 countries in the world, and there are only 195 members of the UN. We dominate the world militarily in ways that are unheard of in history. And of course, we also dominate economically as the largest economy in the world and the country that can sort of call the shots to an extensive degree on world trade and the global economy. Not completely by ourselves, of course, but with an overwhelming influence. Well, that sets the terms for how this world operates, and I think it makes sense to call that an empire.
One of the things that goes hand in hand with running an empire is the flow of information to the citizens, mm-hmm. the recognized citizens of that empire. And I think since you specialize in journalism, mm-hmm. how do you rate the current situation we have here in the U.S. in terms of corporate media and its support of mm-hmm. the concept of empire?
Well, it's complex. I mean, we can't deny that we have a free media in the sense that there's no direct government control of or repression of news media, except in very unusual circumstances. The protections of freedom of speech and freedom of the press in this country are very well developed and very real. The question, of course, though, is in a system in which there is free expression, why is it that the corporate commercial news media. That is what we often call the mainstream news media, which, of course, provide the vast majority of information to the majority of the American public. Why is it that so often they don't fulfill their role as a critical and independent voice in the culture? Journalists talk constantly about their watchdog role, that they conceptualize themselves as, in a democracy, being those people who are outside the system who can bring to bear on the system pressure when there are abuses and offenses. And I think that's an appropriate way to think of journalism in a free society. It should perform that role. But the problem is the way contemporary commercial news media are structured, they don't typically do that. The place you see that the most dramatically is in either the preparations for war or when a nation actually goes to war. It's at that moment, I think, that U.S. journalism fails and fails most profoundly. And there are reasons for it, which we can talk about. But never has that failure, I think, been more dramatic than the run-up to the Iraq War. Instead of fulfilling that role as a critical, independent voice asking very important questions, skeptical questions about a case for war that was being made by the Bush administration, really in the face of opposition from virtually the entire world. I mean, never was there a point where it was more obvious that the American news media should be involved in that kind of independent critical inquiry. And they simply didn't do it in the run-up to the Gulf, the Iraq War. They simply did not fulfill their role that even they claim should be their role. And that's, in a way, what happened is even, and it's a paradox, that even with a free press, the press became almost an extension of the propaganda machinery of the government. And explaining why that is, I think, is a very important part of, you know, assessing the state of democracy in this country.
Do you have any insights into why they would do that?
Well, I think there's been a fair amount of very good critical scholarship over the last 30 years looking at how news media actually operate. And I, drawing on all of that in my own experience as a journalist, my own experience as a political activist, I think it really comes down to three factors that are so powerful in shaping the content of news. One is the nature of the institutions that produce the news. That is, they are corporations. And they are corporations whose revenue stream is almost entirely from advertising. In the case of broadcast TV, for instance, it's 100% advertising. But even newspapers are, even though they charge us 50 cents a pop for the paper, their income is dominated by advertising revenue as well. So you have corporations, which are, of course, for-profit institutions. They exist for one reason and one reason only, which is to generate profit, whose income source is primarily other corporations. Well, you know, that already starts to shape the news, not because those corporate owners wake up every morning and tell journalists, listen, this is the story you will tell today. It doesn't work that way. Journalists are professionals, and they have professional values. But that is also part of the problem. Those professional norms of contemporary journalism, and I want to stress this is a fairly recent development, that American journalism has not always looked the way it's looked. But especially in the post-World War II era, this stress on objective journalism has dominated the professional norms of mainstream journalism. Now, objectivity has to be talked out. If objectivity means don't make stuff up, tell the truth as you see it, and don't be predisposed to eliminate one explanation over another. In other words, don't make stuff up and keep an open mind. Well, if that's what objectivity means, then I'm for objectivity. I'm guessing you're for objectivity. In fact, I don't know anybody who's against objectivity in that sense. The problem is objectivity in journalism, in contemporary mainstream journalism, it really is a code word for a set of practices about how you go about trying to understand the truth of the world. And the most important part of objective reporting is its incredible dependence on official sources, that is, on those sources who have credibility in the culture. And in this culture, that tends to mean government officials, corporate officials, or people who come out of institutions that are deemed credible by the corporations and the government. That means think tanks and universities and such things. Well, those people become the primary news shapers. They're the ones who not only provide information, but they help set the agenda. They help decide what is and isn't news. And as long as journalists are beholden to those kinds of official sources under these rules of objectivity, then they're always going to reflect the conventional wisdom of dominant, powerful institutions. So you've got journalistic institutions, media operations that are themselves corporate and profit-driven, drawing on, for the most part, as their source of news, other dominant, powerful institutions in the culture. The third component, I think, is very important, is the ideological climate in which all of this happens. One of the things to remember, of course, is that American reporters are Americans. They have, for the most part, they have been raised in this culture, and they have absorbed what I would call the mythology of this culture, the ideology. For instance, when you talk about the United States and foreign policy, part of this ideology is that the United States goes forward benevolently in the world, seeking peace, freedom, justice, and democracy for all nations. Well, the fact that our entire history contradicts that doesn't stop people from continuing to say it over and over again, and it doesn't stop teachers from teaching it over and over again. And journalists work in that same ideological climate and absorb those lessons, and often uncritically absorb them. I think the two most important factor or features of this ideology are this belief in the benevolence of the United States foreign policy, and also the naturalness of capitalism, which is part of the ideology of this country as well. Not only that we're a capitalist country and that's good, but that in fact capitalism is the only sane economic system. That's just part of it. It's woven into the fabric of the schools, of the media, of everything in this culture. Well, if you have those dominant institutions in journalism that are corporate, relying heavily on other powerful institutions in the government and other corporations, all within this ideological framework which rarely contests the mythology of America, that's what creates American journalism as a so often almost a kind of propaganda machinery. It's not that it's unbroken. It's not that no journalist ever breaks out and writes a critical story, of course. These are huge institutions. There are thousands of journalists in the country. But we're talking about the pattern, the way in which day in and day out, over time, American journalism tends to fall in line behind pretty much the conventional wisdom of the powerful.
I'm wondering if we can use as an example the New York Times, which has just come out with a correction of their coverage of the Iraq War. Right. And I'm wondering if you could address that. It seems that they were somewhat saying that we did make some mistakes, you know, and we take credit for making some of those mistakes, but really we're gonna try harder, and you should continue to trust us.
Yes. It's very interesting. On the day we're taping this, on Wednesday, the New York Times ran, you know, in a sense, an unprecedented editorial note. You could call it a very long correction. And in it, they respond to some of the criticisms that came out of the anti-war movement, primarily, that the reporting on, especially the question of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq during the build-up to the Iraq War, that the New York Times reporting was systematically distorted, and that, in fact, although the Times doesn't take it up much in their note, that systematically distorted reporting helped convince the public that it was acceptable to go to war. So it's a very important question. And the Times has been critiqued somewhat harshly, especially for the reporting of one particular journalist, Judith Miller, but more for the whole tone of the coverage. So it's good that they're responding. That shows that popular movements can have an effect, that the criticism leveled at the New York Times didn't go unheard. It also shows that American journalism is, in some sense, improving over time. 25 years ago, I can't imagine a correction like this. It just was unthinkable for journalists to actually pay that much attention to the criticisms of it and respond. So in some sense, this is a very good sign, a sign both that activists can have an effect on journalism and that journalism might be in some ways improving. Unfortunately, there's some really unfortunate aspects to the actual correction they wrote. For one thing, it accepts without question this notion that the United States went to war based on intelligence failures. My argument is that the war wasn't based on intelligence failures. It was based on a phenomenally successful propaganda campaign which used intelligence, distorted intelligence, out and out false intelligence at sometimes, and used it very skillfully to manipulate people. But they weren't really intelligence failures from that point of view. the Bush administration and some people in it might have believed things that were untrue. Maybe they did, in fact, believe what some of the Iraqi defectors said about weapons. But the point is, that wasn't the motivation for the war. The Bush administration did not go to war because they really thought there were weapons of mass destruction there. It was a pretext. It was a cover story. And around the world, people almost take this as a given. It's only in the United States that we're still sort of caught up in this quite frankly, kind of insane discussion of intelligence failures. Well, in the Times' correction, they talk about being misled about the intelligence on weapons of mass destruction, just as the U.S. government was misled. So they repeat, sort of implicitly justifying the war, in a sense, as really being about weapons. It was just that they got some bad information. Well, of course, there is an alternative explanation for why the U.S. wanted to go to war, and it's about control over the flow of oil and the flow of oil profits. Now, that's an important argument to make. Even if you're a journalist and you're trying to stay neutral, you should at least present that argument as one of the compelling ways to understand the Iraq War. But the New York Times and most other mainstream journalists never really addressed that issue. Therefore, the weapons become, by default, the only possible reason for war. And then you just have to explain why the intelligence was bad. So to the degree that the Times correction accepts all of that framework, it makes the problem worse because it continues to tell the American people it is about weapons and the only question is whether the intelligence was good or bad and where it came from and why it might have been good or bad intelligence. So that's one thing the Times correction does that I think is very disturbing. The second thing I'm disappointed in is that the correction doesn't seem to have any sense of the larger problem of journalism, which wasn't just the reporting on the Iraq War or the reporting on weapons of mass destruction and intelligence. It's really a fundamental problem, as we said earlier, about this over-reliance, this almost slavish reliance on official sources, which isn't the case simply in the weapons story. It's the case day in and day out. And the Times, in a sense, only seems to be apologizing for, in this particular case, being too quick to accept the dictates of official sources, instead of saying, and this would have been a great opportunity, to step back and reflect and say, well, maybe our whole system of gathering the news has become inordinately dependent on these people. Not just that they're wrong this time, but that our system is wrong. The Times doesn't take the opportunity to do that, which I think is unfortunate because it's moments like this that often lead to that kind of critical self-reflection, either by individuals or institutions. And I think the Times, quite frankly, just isn't up to the task.
Yeah, it seems to fail the entire concept of credibility mm-hmm. and addressing that. Isn't that also somewhat of a catch-22 that you had said earlier that the reason that corporate institutions covering the news go to places like the Pentagon is because the Pentagon has this level of credibility, mm-hmm. but the very fact that they have credibility is due to the fact that the media regularly goes to them and gives sure. them this kind of sure. Space on the altar.
Right. And there are reasons why the news media do rely so heavily on these sources. One is simply that the people who run the media are not that significantly different in outlook, worldview, from the people who run the Pentagon and the White House and the State Department and Congress and the corporate world. In other words, they all come out of a similar background. So it's not surprising they all tend to see the world in the same way. It's not surprising they would see Pentagon officials as credible sources, which on the surface, we might just sort of digress for a minute, is really quite bizarre, given the history of attempts by military, not just the U.S. military, just militaries in general, to deceive and distort and lie and use propaganda. It's, you know, at this point, it's a cliche that military victories are won not only on the battlefield, but in the media as well. And we know perfectly well the military, as well as other powerful people, routinely lie and distort the news for their own purposes. At the same time that we know this, and even the people in the New York Times know this, they're still there at every Pentagon briefing, still putting that stuff on TV and in the papers. So you're right, they build the credibility by constantly deferring to those powerful institutions. There's another reason they do it as well, is quite frankly, it's simply a very cheap way to gather the news. That is, if you can show up at a Pentagon briefing and a credible, quote-unquote, source, the general, hands you the news of the day, well, that's all that you send one reporter, and there you've got a story. as opposed to a much more labor-intensive kind of reporting, which would require people to go out into the world and really look at the complexity of the world, you know, interview lots of people and challenge those pronouncements of the powerful. I'm not saying journalists never do that. Of course, they do that a lot. But especially on matters of war, they do it far too rarely. So the fact is that, you know, using official sources is consistent with usually the worldview of your bosses, and it's cheap and it's easy, and it's a way to produce content with the, you know, minimal number of employees, which is the way you make money. I mean, now we're back to the profit motive. Why would you do that? If you have journalistic values about truth and objectivity, why would you short the staff so that they had to rely on these sort of easier ways to gather news? Well, the easier, any manager knows, you want to increase your profit, the easiest way to cut costs is to cut down your labor force. And that's what journalism does. It gets by with the minimal number of journalists to produce the news.
Where do you see the difference between journalism and when these outlets essentially become propaganda repeaters or propaganda producers?
Well, of course, the line is never clear, and even within a news organization, there can be different journalists doing different kind of work. I think that war is an interesting time because the sense of patriotism, the sense that you have to all rally around the flag, really becomes evident during wartime, and it's an easy time to see the more routine failures of journalism. And certainly in some newsrooms, the line doesn't seem to exist at all. I mean, people routinely in the anti-war movement would target Fox News, the cable channel that was so overtly a booster for the war, willing to put out any story that the Bush administration wanted to float, seizing on every allegation that there had been weapons found in Iraq to trumpet this great victory, and then, you know, correcting the story only much later and in much less sort of emotional terms. So Fox is kind of an easy target. But I think it's much more instructive to look at a network like CNN, which is, it's phenomenal to me that people could do this, but is seen as a liberal network to offset the conservative Fox. Well, there's nothing liberal about CNN at all. And in fact, if you look at their war coverage, it wasn't significantly different than Fox's. There was a difference in tone and style. Fox was more overtly boosterish. But CNN did very little critical reporting of its own, nothing that contradicted or was even skeptical about Bush administration claims. If you look at, you know, one of their main personalities like Wolf Blitzer, I mean, sometimes listening to him, it wasn't clear if you were listening to a journalist or, you know, a government spokesperson. That's the reality, not just of overtly ideological enterprises like Fox News, but even these so-called neutral disseminators of news like CNN. Where is the line in all of that? When do journalists quit being truly independent and become a vehicle for little more than propaganda? Well, in some sense, the minute they decide to, as I said earlier, play that insider game, they've lost, I think, the possibility to really do good, critical, independent journalism. But in the run-up to the Iraq War, it was very hard to find journalists in most mainstream newsrooms who were willing to be that kind of critical and independent voice.
And bringing this back to yourself, you're both a journalist, you're a former journalist, but if you look at your current writings, many would say you're an activist with an agenda.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly true.
How do you balance the two?
I don't balance the two, and I think it's an important distinction. I was a journalist for many years in traditional mainstream commercial newsrooms. Looking back on it, I wasn't a very good journalist because I, in a lot of ways, wasn't able to get outside of that system myself. I took a different path then, went back to graduate school, pursued a university career, and in the past 5 or 6 years especially have been spending a lot of time writing, often for newspapers, the opinion pages of mainstream newspapers, for instance, writing for magazines here and there. But I really don't write as a journalist. People often say that I'm still a journalist, and I say, no, I'm really not. I'm a polemicist, in a sense. I'm active in a lot of political organizations. I have issues I believe in strongly. I want to see political change in this country. So what I do is use the skills of a journalist, you know, gathering information, analysis, writing, which I did learn as a journalist. I'm glad I learned them. And I apply them to political work. But I don't tell people I'm a journalist in the sense that I'm independent. I'm not independent. I'm part of political movements. I think journalists should be independent, not only independent of the large institutions of the culture, not only truly independent of the government and the corporate sector, but also in a sense independent of political movements of any kind. What I think journalists do in a society is provide an independent source of information so that you can not trust completely. You always have to sort of check out people's biases and read critically and read skeptically. But I like to see journalists who aren't beholden to anybody, whether it's a corporation or the government or even a left-leaning political movement that I might endorse. I want to see journalists who are truly independent so that if they do see something that needs to be said, they won't constantly be checking it out for political effect. When I write, I think about the political effect of what I write. I think journalists shouldn't think about that. They should write the truth as they see it, independently. Now, because I have a left political analysis, my own view is that if journalists do that, what they're going to do is systematically look at the way power operates in the culture, and they're going to see the way that power is routinely abused. And if they're good journalists, they're going to ask questions about why does that happen? What's the nature of the institutions in the culture? And I think that kind of journalism will inevitably, when it's done with principle and done with integrity, will produce a critical view of the structures of power in the society. But all of the journalists I really admire and respect really are independent, and that's what I think people should expect from journalists. Me, I'm just a political activist with a keyboard.
Who are some of those journalists that you admire and respect?
Well, I think some of the ones that listeners might have heard of are people like John Pilger. John Pilger is an Australian-born British journalist, or now living in Britain. He writes for newspapers in Britain. He writes for magazines. He does documentary films. He writes very tough and critical pieces, which don't pretend to be neutral in some absolute sense. He has a politics, but mostly it's a politics of criticism of entrenched power and skepticism toward the pronouncements of power, which I think is the stance journalists should take. In doing that, he's often very critical of, for instance, U.S. policy and U.K. policy. And he doesn't hesitate to express that criticism, which is very different than the way mainstream journalists in the U.S. operate. But Pilger is, I think, a very resourceful reporter. His work is well-sourced. He does a lot of work to go to the places he reports on and report back in an honest way. And he is independent. He's not part of any political movement. He sees himself as a journalist whose job it is to bring the truth. I just finished teaching one of his books and several of his documentary films in my introductory journalism class. And I presented him as what I thought was an exemplary case of a truly independent journalist. Another person that's widely read in the U.S. is Robert Fisk, who reports from the Middle East. Again, he's an independent. He actually works for a newspaper called The Independent in London. But he's not part of movements either. Now, he's also harshly critical of U.S. policy, of Israeli policy. He doesn't take some sort of false sense of neutrality into his reporting. But the point I like to make about Fisk is the reason Robert Fisk has those points of view is because he's been reporting on the Middle East for the past 25 years. He knows the region. His opinions, in a sense, aren't based on purely political ideology. His opinions are rooted in his experience in the region. And I think it's important to realize that's what you want from a reporter. Do we want to send a reporter to the Middle East for 25 years and then have this person never really talk about or write about what he or she has learned? Why else would you want the reporter there? So I think people like Fisk and Pilger really point out the the poverty of the American mainstream model in which journalists are forbidden from drawing conclusions, forbidden from speaking in bold and often, you know, very striking language, Fisk especially. Those are journalists I think I learn from. And I think I learn much more than I learn sometimes from the much blander pages of the New York Times. Now, it should be said that in a healthy society that has a really open and democratic system, there would be journalists from a variety of political point of views, journalists with different ways of seeing the world. And as a reader, you could know where they come from, factor that in as you read their reports, and come to conclusions of your own. And I think that's a much healthier system than for journalists to pretend they are purely neutral and can be trusted to have the objective news. I think that just leads, as we've talked about, to reporting that systematically endorses the worldview of powerful institutions and people.
What is your take on the concept of embedded journalists, like became so prominent here in the recent and ongoing conflict in Iraq? Do you necessarily see that as once a journalist is embedded that they'll automatically take up the Pentagon's propaganda that's dishing out?
Right. Well, first of all, we should acknowledge the embedded system in some ways was much better than the system that was used in the 91 Gulf War, in which the U.S. government, the U.S. military, used press pools, so reporters were not allowed out into the field except under highly constrained conditions in a pool system in which then those few reporters reported back to the rest of the media. And there was also overt censorship often. So allowing reporters to go relatively freely into the field with units without a lot of censorship is certainly an improvement. But we have to ask, why did the Pentagon do it and what was the effect? I think the Pentagon did it in part because they understood that in this very hyper-patriotic time, especially after 9/11, U.S. journalists could be trusted, so to speak, to have the right views. And they also knew that if you embedded reporters and made them dependent on those military units for everything, for transportation, for food, for protection, and if you put reporters in conditions like that, that they would tend to adopt the worldview of the people they were covering. It's not surprising. It would be unusual if they didn't. And so the Pentagon, in a sense, looked like they were being open, but in fact were creating a system that was almost certainly going to be very beneficial to them in the sense that those reports that came back from American journalists would largely reflect the point of view of the Pentagon. And in fact, that's exactly what happened, that the mainstream, especially the television reports, tended to have really two major features. On one hand, especially before the war, they were reports on the morale of troops and how are our fighting men and women doing over there, which tended to really glorify the military. And then once the war began, much of the reporting, especially the television reporting, was simply a grand narrative of the grand march of the grand U.S. Army to victory. Some of them actually had, I was always struck when I would watch by the way in which they almost resembled a slightly higher-tech version of those old World War II newsreels that you see clips from. Da-da-da-da, news marches on, and the American troops hit the beaches in Normandy. And those newsreels were not really news. They were part of the war promotion effort. Watching CNN, I sometimes felt like I was just watching the high-tech video live satellite-fed version of that same thing. So you have to look at the embedded reporting system as a whole and look at the patterns of the coverage, and I think those patterns were, without much exception, highly beneficial to the Pentagon because they put forward a view of the war from the eyes of the U.S. military. Now, as you point out, though, that didn't mean that every report was simply propaganda for the military, but it was very hard for people to break out. There were some good stories done by embedded reporters. But even very good reporters, there happens to be an NPR reporter who lives in Austin, Texas, and I was talking to him about this, and he's actually written about it. Once he came back from Iraq, he was had been a very big proponent of the embedded system while he was there. But he said once he got back and he sort of looked at his coverage, he realized he had kind of become an unwitting propaganda agent. And he saw that while he was in Iraq with those units, he really did adopt their point of view. And he said it became clear to them that he was always reporting from the place where the mortars were being fired, never on the other side with the Iraqis, where the mortars were landing. And his name is John Burnett. And he went back and actually did a report looking at the war from the other side. Now, this was after the war was over and after the propaganda achievement had already been, you know, solidified. So in a sense, it was too little too late, because that kind of critical reporting about, for instance, what was happening to Iraqi civilians during the war would have been much more important while the war was going on. But because the American news media was largely embedded, there wasn't much of that reporting. So I think even some of the journalists who were there are starting to have second thoughts about what the embedded system did to them and to their reporting. And the sad part is, though, much of the American news media is wildly enthusiastic about embedding, because it gave them what they really wanted, which was access to troops, access to the pictures, access to the steady flow of news that had all of the drama of being from the front.
So do you think that concept would have corrupted even good journalists like Fisk and Pilger?
Well, Robert Fisk was there in Iraq and notably not as an embedded reporter. So again, he made the choice not to play, in a sense, that a different version of that inside game. And to be fair to the American news media, some of the major outlets did have non-embedded reporters in Iraq. It was very dangerous. But the New York Times had at least one, maybe more. There were journalists from mainstream news outlets. But here's what's interesting. If you look at their reporting, it still is well within the framework that the Bush administration set for the war. In other words, it wasn't really critical of the fundamental assertions that were made about that war. So in that sense, whether they were embedded or not embedded, the mainstream reporters still largely were not terribly critical and not terribly independent, whereas reporters from other countries, you could see the difference. I mean, it's always a good way to test journalism within one's own country is to compare it to journalists from outside the country who are covering the same stories. And here, you know, many listeners will know perfectly well, it was almost night and day. The picture of the war that we were getting in the United States through commercial news media was radically different than what much of the rest of the world was seeing. And I don't mean just the Arab world. This was often talked about as if, you know, it was only those people who watched Al Jazeera, the Arabic language satellite network, that were getting these alternative views. But it was everywhere, all of the Third World, Western Europe. Got a very different picture of the war than the United States did, because those reporters were not constrained in some of the same ways that American reporters are by this ideology. And especially, again, it's important to mark, in a post 9/11 United States, an ideology of really hyper-patriotism, an assumption that you cannot challenge the fundamental notion that the United States is this benevolent power trying to do good in the world. That, probably more than anything, constrained American journalism.
So since 9/11, then, corporate media, you believe, has gotten significantly worse?
Well, worse in some ways. I mean, again, these are complex systems, and there is a lot of good reporting you can see in the American news media. But I think it's not only corporate media, but the entire culture. And here, you could point to my own profession now of university teaching. The space open for people to be critical of U.S. policy since 9/11 really did contract considerably. People may remember that after 9/11, the months immediately after, it was very difficult to voice any kind of criticism of, in that case, the mad rush to war in Afghanistan. Those of us who did voice critiques were often savaged, you know, and critiqued harshly. And that's fine. I don't mind my ideas being engaged in critique. The problem was people weren't critiquing my ideas or my claims. Mostly what they were critiquing was me personally. How dare you speak like this? And that's not really a functional democracy when people aren't allowed to engage those dissident or alternative ideas. So in that sense, the U.S. news media is simply one more institution in the culture that kind of was locked down after 9/11, where critical thought was very difficult. It certainly happened on university campuses. It certainly happened on my campus, the University of Texas, which is admittedly a relatively conservative state. But I heard stories from people all over the country you know, people who said, you know, I'm against the war, but if I try to speak about it at work, my coworkers walk away, won't even talk to me. I heard many a story about family dinners that were ripped asunder by such political debate, where people just said, listen, you can't critique the U.S. right now. Well, when that infects the news media as well, which it clearly did, then you're not only, you know, having a problem around the family dinner table, you're losing an institution that should be providing a critical and independent voice, but is simply unable to do it at that moment.
It seems like it is the institution that is, you know, the primary catalyst towards transmission of ideas in this society.
Yeah, I think there are, you know, two that we should look to, two institutions. One is news media, and the other is the school system, both the public schools, the K through 12, and importantly also the university system. And I think the some of the critiques of news media that you can make are equally applied to universities. And these are the two institutions I've spent my entire adult life in. That's all the only places I've ever worked. And I see great parallels between the news media and the universities. One of the chapters in Citizens of the Empire is, in fact, a critique of the response of American universities after 9/11, where just like my argument that journalism failed American democracy and failed quite profoundly in the run-up to the Iraq War, I think American universities after 9/11 also failed the culture. They failed to provide the space for a really engaged kind of political dialogue, which is what this country so desperately needed after 9/11. And universities were perfectly situated to do. They have the resources, they have the expertise, and at least on my campus, the university simply refused to fill that role.
So talk about, if you would, then, how we as citizens get back that space mm-hmm. for dialogue in the universities, in the media, and amongst our friends and
sure. Well, family. Of course, one way you get back space is simply by claiming it, which means that people have to not give in to the sense of political paralysis or hopelessness, and also not give in to the fear. After 9/11, there were a lot of people who told me they were afraid to speak. Now, for some people in certain categories, especially Arab, South Asian, Muslim people, especially those who were immigrants and not necessarily permanent citizens, that fear was real and justified because the U.S. government, you know, engaged in a really brutal repression, throwing as many as 1,200 Arab and South Asian men into essentially secret detention for usually what turned out to be very minor visa violations. Well, that was a real assault on civil liberties in the culture. But while that was going on, people who look like me, I'm white, I'm middle class, professional, educated, I had all the freedom of speech I needed. Nobody was going to throw me in jail. In fact, nobody did throw me in jail. So people with that kind of protection and privilege often felt afraid to speak. And my response was, why? I mean, I've been criticizing the administration and the war vociferously and from a position of some public prominence because I work at a major university and the FBI isn't dragging me away. So in a sense, if we internalize that fear too much, then they win by definition, they being those powerful institutions that want to derail that. The other thing is, I think we should recognize that America, after World War II, has become a systematically less politicized society. That is, in a country where there used to be a lot of lively political engagement, even in times when there was a fair amount of repression, partly out of the, you know, design of a propaganda system that wants to depoliticize people, people have felt less connected to politics. And I don't just mean through voting. I mean they have not engaged in the kind of day-to-day political discourse that keeps a democracy healthy. If you go even, you know, in faculty in where I work, which are supposed to be the big intellectuals, you know, the one place you'd think you'd find a lot of political conversation would be in the faculty club. After all, these are the intellectuals. And I'm constantly surprised how much of the conversation steadfastly avoids politics, as if somehow it's impolite to talk about politics. Well, that's a battle we all have to fight, in a sense, to repoliticize American society, to repoliticize day-to-day life. And you do that by doing it. And of course, you don't do it alone. We always have to remember that progressive political change comes through organization, coming together with other people. And that's what I spend a lot of time trying to do in Austin, in my local political activity and organizing. I work with a group called the Third Coast Activist Resource Center, which Third Coast is a kind of a conceit that we have that, you know, sure, the West Coast and the East Coast exist, but we're a coast too. We've got the Gulf Coast and we're the Third Coast. It's a term that comes out of the music industry in Austin. Anyway, most of what we do at that center is try to engage with people, create public events where speakers come or show films that have provocative messages, and not only bring in the big expert or bring in the film, but then create places where people can engage and try to spark that kind of public dialogue. And those are tasks that anybody can engage in, but it really is the kind of thing that is more meaningful when you do it collectively. So, you know, that's back to square one of politics. If you don't have money to buy yourself results, which of course the corporate world can do, you're left with the power of people. It's an old adage. You know, if you don't have money, you have, if you don't have organized money, you have organized people. And we're really at the beginnings of building that kind of movement in the United States. But it's incredibly important work, I think. If people want to look at what we're doing in Austin, there's a website at thirdcoastactivist.org that gives a flavor of the kind of work we do. But of course, you know, here in Seattle, there's, you know, this is one of the most politically vibrant cities that I know of in terms of left, progressive, anti-war organizing. So there's certainly, you know, much activity going on here.
Seems I've been hearing from a lot of people that we are at a very critical juncture here in terms of in this country right now, and in terms of history of Western civilization of the planet. What other words would you like to share with listeners about that?
Well, I think crisis is a good way to understand this. Certainly there have been other empires, there have been other disastrous wars, but I think if you combine the overwhelming power of the United States and the destructive capacity of the U.S. military, as well as the ecological crisis that the world is facing, and the fact that technology has speeded up all of this, it's, to me, feels like a time when we don't have time to waste. At the same time, we have to understand that political change is a long-term struggle, that there's an urgency to it that may be unique, but that the solution is still the same old solution of bringing people together, committed to a long-term process of change. Because the institutions that are so powerful today, especially corporate institutions, they didn't get there overnight. They've been systematically shaping society and shaping the public mind. I mean, when we go into public to argue, we're not going in on equal footing. We're going in a sense, up against a propaganda industry that's been very effective. So I think people have to both have that sense of urgency, but also have realistic expectations about what can be done and in what time frame. And the other thing I would just reinforce is if people do feel like there's just no hope, that, you know, George Bush and the reactionary ideologues who run his administration and the corporate world and the, you know, fanatically fundamentalist religious right, you know, if you look around, it's a grim story in a sense. But history is full of examples of people who stood up to very entrenched power. I always use the example of the abolitionist movement. The white abolitionist movement in the U.S. started in about 1815, at a time when slavery was, you know, entrenched. All of the society was in favor of it for the most part. Well, if you combine the agitation of the slave revolts on the plantations with the activities of the abolitionist movement, they overthrew an incredibly powerful system, or were part of the process by which that was overthrown. Well, history is full of those examples of people who were willing to take on entrenched power. And then my final thought is that in doing that, even if you don't win immediately, there are tremendous rewards to being involved in political activity. It is a struggle, but in my own life, at least I can speak only from that experience, there is a lot of joy in that struggle. It's a way to connect to other people on a deeper and more meaningful level. I can think of the most important friends I have are almost all people I've met through political work, where there's a common concern and a common commitment. I'm here in Seattle partly because I'm one of those people I met, one of your most vigorous local activists on the anti-war front, Bert Sachs, who I met at a conference in 4 or 5 years ago. You know, just the experience of knowing Bert, who's just a really committed and principled person, has enriched my life. And that's what motivates me to keep going, even when I look around and see a world that seems bent on destroying itself. But of course, that will happen only if we let it happen.
Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. Well,
great conversation. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Thank you. We've just been talking with Robert Jensen. He is professor of journalism at the University of Texas and author of the new book, Citizens of the Empire: The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity.